We come to the end of chapter 11 this evening, the master of the work. Developing the idea of who it is who leads, guides, engenders actually the work, Sri Aurobindo naturally turns for inspiration to the Bhagavad Gita. But his message goes farther. We'll see that towards the close of this chapter. This first paragraph is a long one, but I'm going to read the entire thing, and then we'll come back and we'll look at it a little at a time. But that is the end of a long and difficult journey. And the master of works does not wait till then to meet the seeker on the path of yoga and put his secret or half-shown hand upon him and upon his life and actions. Already he was there in the world as the originator and receiver of works behind the dense veils of the inconscient, disguised in force of life, visible to the mind through symbol godheads and figures. It may well be in these disguises that he first meets the soul destined to the way of the integral yoga, or even wearing still vaguer masks. He may be conceived by us as an ideal or mentalized as an abstract power of love, good, beauty, or knowledge. Or, as we turn our feet towards the way, he may come to us veiled as the call of humanity, or a will in things that drives towards the deliverance of the world from the grasp of darkness and falsehood and death and suffering, the great quaternary of the ignorance. Then, after we have entered the path, he envelops us with his wide and mighty liberating impersonality, or moves near to us with the face and form of a personal Godhead. In and around us, we feel a power that upholds and protects and cherishes. We hear a voice that guides. A conscious will greater than ourselves rules us. An imperative force moves our thought and actions and our very body. An ever-widening consciousness assimilates ours. A living light of knowledge lights all within, or a beatitude invades us. A mightiness presses from above, concrete, massive, and overpowering, and penetrates and pours itself into the very stuff of our nature. A peace sits there, a light, a bliss, a strength, a greatness. Or there are relations, personal, intimate as life itself, sweet as love, encompassing like the sky, deep like deep waters. A friend walks at our side, a lover is with us in our heart's secrecy, a master of the work and the ordeal points our way. A creator of things uses us as his instrument. We are in the arms of the Eternal Mother. All these more seizable aspects in which the ineffable meets us are truths and not mere helpful symbols or useful imaginations. But as we progress, their first imperfect formulations in our experience yield to a larger vision of the one truth that is behind them. At each step, their mere mental masks are shed, and they acquire a larger, a profounder, a more intimate significance. At last, on the supramental borders, all these godheads combine their forces and, without at all ceasing to be, coalesce together. On this path, the divine aspects are not revealed in order to be cast away. They are not temporary spiritual conveniences or compromises with an illusory consciousness or dream figures mysteriously cast upon us by the incommunicable superconscience of the Absolute. On the contrary, their power increases and their absoluteness reveals itself as they draw near to the truth from which they issue. So let's back up and look at the master of the works. In the Gita, it is revealed as the Purushottama, the Supreme Person. Already he was there in the world as the originator and receiver of works. This is the Supreme. In the fourth chapter, in the sixth shloka, who through his self Maya establishes all this world. The originator and the receiver of works behind the dense veils of the inconscient. This is the Gita, chapter 9, verses 4 through 8. Visible through the mind, visible to the mind through symbol, godheads, and figures. And this would be the Gita, the 10th chapter of the 8th shloka. I am the birth of everything, and from me all proceeds, Krishna says. But Krishna is the human personification of the Supreme Person, the Purushottama. It may well be in these disguises that he first meets the soul destined to the way of the integral yoga, or even wearing still vaguer masks, he may be conceived by us as an ideal, etc., etc. So all these ways, there is one supreme Godhead, a person, a conscious being, who, populating a self-created world with his own energies and intelligences, shines as the devas, beckons as the great ideas, and every one of them in some way figures what is the nature of that supreme. And so by whatever way you go, whatever door that you open has been placed there, and you have been appointed to that moment where you come to a wakefulness. You don't have to fully awaken, but something in you has to stir and respond. It can be an ideal. It can be an ethical ideal. It can be the pursuit of beauty, the intense search for knowledge. Even in the materialistic sciences, doors open that bring people into a sense of felt oneness with the all around, and then into a deeper domain where the psychology of the person meets the psychology of the world. He continues writing and then says, then after we have entered the path, he envelops us with his wide and mighty liberating impersonality. In other words, one is thrown into a wider consciousness. The ego is discarded with, and one meets this vast reality. But one may go on and move into communion, into connection with the face and form of a personal Godhead. Both of these signify steps in Sri Aurobindo's own sadhana. Because first he had the liberating impersonality in which world and personhood fell away, and there was only the sheer reality of that supreme, a nirvana of all that was phenomenal, and only that abode. But within a year, incarcerated in jail, sitting in solitary confinement, he met the one who uses that ground of impersonal being through which to effectuate his will, that there is a purpose, a telos, a design in the cosmos. At least it is traceable to those who are most conscious, who want to grow in consciousness, who aspire, who want to rid themselves of every integument, of all that opposes, of all that blocks, and live open and free in the Supreme. So, this was Sri Aurobindo's experience. If he awakened in 1908 with the impersonal, then by 1909 he lived in the universal Godhead, a supreme person. The one did not cancel out the other, but fulfilled the other. And then by 1910, he took the discovery of those greater realms of consciousness above, the superconscient leading to the supramental, with him as a pattern of yoga that he could embark upon from the solitude of his cave of tapasya in Pondicherry, where everyone today has a cave of tapasya. And there worked out what I think casts the greatest possibilities before humanity for their choice. Do we choose? So he writes here, we hear a voice that guides, the Adesh that brought Sri Aurobindo first to Chandranagar and then down to Pondicherry, a conscious will greater than ourselves that would not let him continue to exploit political possibilities to work for India's freedom, but had him work rather for the liberation of the cosmos. An imperative force moves our thought and actions in our very body. All of this is redolent in his record of yoga. An ever-widening consciousness assimilates ours. A living light of knowledge lights all within, or a beatitude invades us. And everywhere he goes, he meets only this. In the Gita, in the closing chapter, the 61st verse says, the Lord is seated in the heart of all beings, turning them as if mounted upon a machine. And Sri Aurobindo found that regardless of what his will was, this would work through him until his own sense of egoity was abolished. And then he lived in an unending communion with that Purushottama. We turn the page, or there are relations, personal, intimate as life itself, sweet as love, encompassing like the sky, deep like deep waters. A friend walks at our side, a lover is with us in our heart's secrecy, and just a few verses later in the Gita, at the close of the chapter, says, I am doing this all for you, come to me. Let me live in your consciousness. Let me live in your heart. Give all your works to me, and I will lift you out of all perplexity. I will lift you out of all suffering. I will bring to you my great peace because you are dear to me. Priya, you are dear to me. A master of the work points our way. A creator uses us as his instrument. We are in the arms of the Eternal Mother. By doing all actions lodged in me, he attains by my grace the eternal, the imperishable. We are in the arms of the Eternal Mother. All these more seizable aspects in which the Ineffable meets us are truths and not mere helpful symbols or useful imaginations. So, the Mother, seizable aspects. Sounds familiar, yes? So, in the first paragraph of the sixth chapter, the four powers of the Mother are four of her outstanding personalities, portions and embodiments of her divinity through whom she acts on her creatures, orders and harmonizes her creations in the worlds, and directs the working out of her thousand forces. Sri Lalita Sahasranam, another collection of symbols pregnant with life. For the Mother is one, but she comes before us with differing aspects. Many are her powers and personalities, many her emanations and vibhutis that do her work in the universe. The one whom we adore as the Mother is the divine conscious force that dominates all existence, one and yet so many-sided that to follow her movement is impossible even for the quickest mind and for the freest and most vast intelligence. The Mother is the consciousness and force of the Supreme, and far above all she creates. But something of her ways can be seen and felt through her embodiments, and the more seizable, because more defined, and limited temperament and action of the goddess forms in whom she consents to be manifest to her creatures. So we find Sri Aurobindo hearkening back to the primary texts, Bhagavad Gita, which he studied until it became part of his own being, the Mother, which came out of his own being. He writes again and again, as if having heard that divine voice, it echoes again and again through him, vibrates in his pen as he writes. It must be spoken again and again. At last, on the supramental borders, all these godheads combine their forces and, without at all ceasing to be, coalesce together. So if all the radiance that comes out from the Supreme represent each ray a possible path leading back, then as one returns, one finds massed in complete harmony the place where we all started. It's above, waiting for us there, the home that continues to support us even as we struggle and labor and grow consciously below. The one awaits the return of the many. And he closes that paragraph. Their power increases and their absolute reveals itself as they draw near to the truth from which they issue. This is the very symbol of the ascent of the Vedic sacrifice. One offers oneself, really? It is oneself one offers on the Vedi, on the altar, and it is one's energies and collected thoughts and experiences that move upwards, rising with us to the Godheads who wait for us there. And as we rise and conjoin ourselves with them, becoming one with them in a divine company, we continue to grow. We grow towards that sun from which all radiance comes. This is the living power of the Rig Veda. So let's continue then. Back to his essay. For that now superconscient transcendence is a power as well as an existence. So we're speaking about a transcendence, but it is a reality that is manifold. It is not a sheer oneness. One can feel in it the supremacy of existence, which presents itself through its native power. And the enjoyer of all of this is again its conscious, powerful self. So again, he hints at the reality of Satchit-Ananda coming out of that unknowable, whatever that might be, whatever name you wish to give it. And it's worth noting that all of the possibilities as we regard existence from the level of the mind are real to our experience. And so every perspective has a kind of truth in it. Those who look above, beyond Satchit-Ananda, say there's an unknowable, there's an unnameable. Is it? Is it not? Is it Sat? Is it Asat? That has justified, in a way, the vacuity of being. We don't know if we exist or not, because ultimately we escape even the positive definition of being. So does nirvana blow out the being? It can. And it might not, because there is the self-assignation of that unknowable as a positive reality, as a sat. And in that sat, there is consciousness. And there is power, and there is bliss. And that is the positive nature of being as a transcendence. That transcendence can position itself in a still lower order of being, in what we know is our moving and ever-shifting universe. But it is a translation of a manifestation that always exists beyond the realm and the touch of time. Sri Aurobindo continues, the supramental transcendence is not a vacant wonder, but an inexpressible which contains forever all essential things that have issued from it. It holds them there in their supreme everlasting reality and their own characteristic absolutes. The diminution, division, degradation that create here the sense of an unsatisfactory puzzle, a mystery of Maya, themselves diminish and fall from us in our ascension. And the divine powers assume their real forms and appear more and more as the terms of a truth in process of realization here. A soul of the divine is here slowly awaking out of its involution and concealment in the material and conscience. So see what he's done. The end of the last paragraph. Their power increases, and their absoluteness reveals itself as they draw near to the truth from which they issue. And then here, and the divine powers assume their real forms and appear more and more as the terms of a truth in process of realization here. These are matched. This is a brace. The master of our works is not a master of illusions, but a supreme reality who is working out his self-expressive realities, delivered slowly from the cocoons of the ignorance in which, for the purposes of an evolutionary manifestation, they were allowed for a while to slumber. For the supramental transcendence is not a thing absolutely apart and unconnected with our present existence. It is a greater light out of which all this has come for the adventure of the soul, lapsing into the inconscience and emerging out of it And while that adventure proceeds, it waits superconscient above our minds till it can become conscious in us. Hereafter, it will unveil itself, and by the unveiling, reveal to us all the significance of our own being and our works. For it will disclose the divine, whose fuller manifestation in the world will release and accomplish that covert significance. And this echoes the close of the last chapter in The Mother. Let's see if we can find it. The supramental change is a thing decreed and inevitable in the evolution of the earth consciousness. For its upward ascent is not ended, and mind is not its last summit. But that the change may arrive, take form, and endure, there is needed the call from below with a will to recognize and not deny the light when it comes, and there is needed the sanction of the Supreme from above. The power that mediates between the sanction and the call is the presence and power of the Divine Mother. The Mother's power, and not any human endeavor and tapasya, can alone rend the lid and tear the covering and shape the vessel and bring down into this world of obscurity and falsehood and death and suffering truth and light and life divine and the immortals Ananda. And now he summarizes all these poises possible in the nature of the cosmic work. The transcendent, the cosmic, and the individual coming to point. In that disclosure, the transcendent divine will be more and more made known to us as the supreme existence and the perfect source of all that we are. But equally, we shall see him as a master of works and creation, prepared to pour out more and more of himself into the field of his manifestation. And this is in the Gita, in the 15th chapter, shlokas 18 through 19, where he describes the Purushottama. The field of his manifestation. The cosmic consciousness and its action will appear no longer as a huge regulated chance, but as a field of the manifestation. Kshetra. And who is the knower of the field? Kshetrajna. There, the divine is seen as a presiding and pervading cosmic spirit who receives all out of the transcendence and develops what descends into forms that are now an opaque disguise or a baffling half-disguise, but destined to be a transparent revelation. So this is a ground in which individuals and persons ultimately appear and populate with growing personalities and avid, interested souls, the so-called field. The individual consciousness will recover its true sense and action, for it is the form of a soul sent out from the Supreme, and in spite of all appearances, a nucleus or nebula in which the Divine Mother Force is at work for the victorious embodiment of the timeless and formless divine in time and matter. So, from the transcendent, in the field of the cosmic, here comes the soul. And the Gita again speaks to that in the 15th chapter, the 7th shloka. It is an eternal portion of me that becomes the jiva in the world of living creatures and cultivates the subjective powers of prakriti, mind, and the five senses. So, from the Supreme stands forth above and supernal to the world the realities of the jivas, the jivatmans, who then populate the earth with the living souls, which are them in action as the one in action. And it's a nucleus and a nebula that he refers to here. The nucleus from the Latin, nux, which means a nut. So it refers to a central mass or a kernel, the real core. So the soul is the real core of the individual. So the reality is there. Sri Aurobindo and the Gita both accord a reality to the nature of the individual. So it's a nucleus or it's a nebula. Nebula also from the Latin, which means mist, or from the Greek, nepele, which means, again, a cloud or mist. So it's that which in a sense mystifies, which covers the nature of things, blocks the direct view. So you look, you say, well, is it or is it not? But it is also a nucleus. There is at the center a reality. A nucleus or nebula in which the divine mother force, the Mahashakti, is at work for the victorious embodiment of the timeless and formless divine in time and matter. So to bring those realities here, to bring eternity into immortality in the perishable mortal form. This will reveal itself slowly to our vision and experience as the will of the Master of Works and as their own ultimate significance, which alone gives to world creation and to our own action in the world a light and a meaning. To recognize that and to strive towards its effectuation is the whole burden of the way of divine works in the integral yoga. So Sri Aurobindo has brought an insistent note, an affirmation of both individual and the cosmos that the individual lives in. There is nothing like this in the rest of Vedantic literature. Sri Aurobindo's genius and insistence is that reality really is one. And in all apparent division, there is the unifying force of the one existent. And there is a purpose in the manifestation. It is not accidental. It is not adventitious. There is a telos. There is a goal. The divine will achieve its goal through whatever significant form it develops. But it is not a singular goal. It is a collective goal. We are all members of a divine family, all come here to join together in a common work, to throw off this ignorance, to throw off this suffering, to live from the shining core of our own immortal souls, without blockage, without veiling. And if a mist delights us, then we'll wear the mist, and when it delights us not, we'll put it aside. So that's the end of chapter 11. Chapter 12, the divine work, comes next, and so we'll take that up next week. If you'll permit a reading from Savitri tonight, this is early in the book. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. This is in Canto 2, the issue. It's a bit long, but I think it's relevant to us. In her, the superhuman cast its seed. Inapt to fold its mighty wings of dream, her spirit refused to hug the common soil, or, finding all life's golden meanings robbed, compound with earth, struck from the starry list, or quench with black despair the God-given light. Accustomed to the eternal and the true, her being, conscious of its divine founts, asked not from mortal frailty pain's relief, patched not with failure, bargain, or compromise. A work she had to do, a word to speak, writing the unfinished story of her soul in thoughts and actions graved in nature's book, she accepted not to close the luminous page, cancel her commerce with eternity, or set a signature of weak assent to the brute balance of the world's exchange. A force in her that toiled since earth was made, accomplishing in life the great world plan, pursuing after death immortal aims, repugned to admit frustration's barren role, forfeit the meaning of her birth in time, obey the government of the casual fact, or yield her high destiny up to passing chance. In her own self she found her high recourse. She matched with the iron law her sovereign right. Her single will opposed the cosmic rule. To stay the wheels of doom, this greatness rose. At the unseen's knock upon her hidden gates, her strength, made greater by the lightning's touch, awoke from slumber in her heart's recess. It bore the stroke of that which kills and saves. Across the awful march no eye can see, barring its dreadful route no will can change, she faced the engines of the universe. A heart stood in the way of the driving wheels. Its giant workings paused in front of a mind. Its stark conventions met the flame of a soul. A magic leverage suddenly is caught that moves the veiled ineffable's timeless will. A prayer, a master act, a king idea, can link man's strength to a transcendent force. Then miracle is made the common rule, One mighty deed can change the course of things. A lonely thought becomes omnipotent. All now seems nature's massed machinery, an endless servitude to material rule and long determination's rigid chain, her firm and changeless habits aping law, her empire of unconscious deft device, annul the claim of man's free human will. He too is a machine amid machines. A piston brain pumps out the shapes of thought. A beating heart cuts out emotion's modes. An insentient energy fabricates a soul. Or the figure of the world reveals the signs of a tide chance repeating her old steps and circles around matter's binding posts. A random series of inept events to which reason lends elusive sense is here, or the empiric life's instinctive search, or a vast ignorant mind's colossal work. But wisdom comes, and vision grows within. Then nature's instrument crowns himself her king. He feels his witnessing self and conscious power. His soul steps back and sees the light supreme. A godhead stands behind the brute machine. This truth broke in a triumph of fire. A victory was won for God and man. The deity revealed its hidden face. The great world mother now in her arose. A living choice reversed fate's cold, dead turn, affirmed the spirit's tread on circumstance, pressed back the senseless, dire, revolving wheel, and stopped the mute march of necessity. A flaming warrior from the eternal peaks, empowered to force the door denied and closed, smote from death's visage its dumb absolute, and burst the bounds of consciousness and time. End of Canto 2. Namaste. Jai Ma.